So for those of you who have come in since 8:30, which I think is most people here, I again am Wendy Johnson. I'm the moderator of the session, so I get to introduce myself. We have the bookends of this panel are both about Mozambique and from Health Alliance International and the University of Washington. I am a clinical assistant professor at the Department of Global Health and the University of Washington and the director of new initiatives for Health Alliance International. And I've worked in Mozambique for a few years. If you were here at 8:30, you heard Steve's presentation about the scale up. And during part of that time, I was there. And I'm going to focus a little bit more for my presentation on specifically the integration of PMTCT and treatment, an important aspect that's often neglected for pregnant HIV-positive women into routine maternal care. So PMTCT implementation, it's an apparently simple technology of just one pill for the mother and one pill for the child. Now the regimens have gotten more complicated, but when it was first introduced, that was the accepted regimen and shouldn't have been, you know, everyone was sort of thinking, well, this shouldn't be very hard to do. But it has proven pretty difficult to implement. It prevents transmission, few of the reasons I think, it prevents transmission to children, but there's no benefit for mothers. And in fact, that first regimen that was used for many, many years may even be detrimental to mothers in inducing resistance to antiretrovirals that later, sometimes very soon, they might have to take. The efficacy of PMTCT regimens is also partly undone by infant feeding practices in many countries, and that focus on that period is far less intense than the focus on the antenatal and very recent postnatal period. PMTCT implementation began in Mozambique, where I worked in 2002, in a lot of places in sub-Saharan Africa around the same time. And at that time, as I said, the regimen was single-dose nevirapine for mothers and single-dose nevirapine for infants in the newborn period. There was an option for AZT from the third trimester, but it was only available at HIV treatment centers, so women had to go specifically to HIV treatment centers to get that. So implementation of PMTCT has largely been driven by funding that's specifically for PMTCT and HIV-related programs and is separated out from other kinds of maternal child health interventions. And I think that's driven a kind of implementation that has separated it from routine maternal care services. It's been implemented primarily by NGOs. In a lot of places, NGOs have gone into health systems and seen that health systems in sub-Saharan Africa are terribly degraded with huge human resources challenges. And their response to this has been not to strengthen those health systems, partly because the donors' constraints on funding makes it difficult to do that in many instances, but instead to say, well, if we don't have enough nurses in this clinic, and if we don't have a building or a space where we can really give counseling and testing adequately, let's build our own thing over here where we can do it the way we want to do it. And that way we can control the environment, and that's what's really the first, I would say, many years of PMTCT implementation. That was the major model in most of sub-Saharan Africa. And there was a result in 2006, the most recent report card of PMTCT services, only about 20% of women had access, and only about 15% of children. And that's looking at that single-dose nevirapine, any kind of regimen, which still largely is a single-dose nevirapine regimen. And that's not very effective either in prevention. Now, access to health care overall in Africa is low, but in antenatal care, attendance exceeds 70% and often 90% in urban areas in many countries. And so here is this hugely accessed health service over here that we're ignoring. Meanwhile, we're trying to get women to go into this new service, and no, women aren't coming to it. Just to show you the graph of the percentage of women that are getting access to PMTCT services, at this rate, I think it's UNAIDS goal for PMTCT is 80% coverage by 2010, and at this rate you see we're not even close to getting there. So the area again where we work in Mozambique is the central provinces, Manica and Sofala. You've seen this in Steve's presentation, the first presentation in the morning, but I'll just reiterate that it's very high HIV prevalence, but also very high prevalence of syphilis, malaria, TB, and malnutrition in these areas. So our integration model, so in about 2005, I would say, we started thinking about how we could better utilize and integrate PMTCT services into the regular routine provision of antenatal care. And the model that we came up with over time was that one nurse providing the antenatal care package should provide really all the interventions that women need, a very patient-centered model. And that should include syphilis testing, the provision of preventive treatment for malaria, and HIV testing, among other interventions. That, you know, taking blood from a woman multiple times in the same day doesn't make any sense for anybody. It's a human resources drain. It's the women, you know, it's hard on them. So combining HIV and syphilis testing. That confidential pre-test and post-test counseling should happen in the context of the routine visit, and that on-site CD4 testing and triage for HIV women into antiretroviral treatment should be integrated in part of the routine antenatal care, so that it's not just something to prevent transmission of the child, so that we're actually treating HIV in women as well. And that we should make that treatment for HIV for women as easy as possible by decentralizing antiretroviral treatment into the same health centers where antenatal care is offered. So we had some experience in this, even as early as 2002, with implementing both syphilis rapid syphilis testing and intermittent preventive treatment for malaria into the routine antenatal services offered at the public health system and the Ministry of Health health clinics in Manica and Sofala. And what we saw with the introduction of rapid syphilis testing is about a 40% increase in syphilis screening for women in the two-year period after that was introduced. I mean, you can see also here, let's see, I'll use this. We started the intermittent preventive treatment for malaria in 2003 in some pilot sites, and in 2004 and 2005 scaled that up to across the two provinces, and also by the end of 2006 we're reaching almost 70% of the women in all antenatal clinics with that intervention. So integrated opt-out HIV testing, I'm sorry for this graph being so tiny, but the important thing is that it started to be implemented in antenatal care clinics at the end of 2005, the beginning of 2006, and by the second quarter of 2006, we saw a sharp uptake in testing, acceptance of testing of women, by about, in all clinics, 535 patients per month. And we were identifying more HIV, women who are HIV positive, and we were seeing more women arrive at the day hospital for treatment as well. The other intervention that sort of coincided with this, that Steve talked about again this morning, was the decentralized ARV treatment to more and more rural and small health centers. And we saw that the number, that really made a difference. We compared, during the time we were scaling up those services, we compared the first services, the centralized services that had been started in the major cities of Bera and Chamoyo. There were a network of prenatal care centers that were all referring to these day hospitals in Bera and Chamoyo. And in the case of Chamoyo, the hospital was only about two blocks away from one of the antenatal care centers. But even just that two blocks made a huge difference, as you can see, in comparison to the other centers of Nyamatanda and Katindika, were the first two decentralized centers that were open, integrated into the primary care of the clinics. And the HIV treatment was the next building over instead of two blocks over. It just made a huge difference with the odds ratio of about 7.2. And the number of women who actually arrived and enrolled for treatment who were referred. So achieving integration, again, just want to mention, really the idea is looking at it from a patient-centered perspective rather than a clinician-centered perspective or an NGO-centered perspective or even a health center-centered perspective. It's really looking at what's going to be the easiest for patients and taking advantage of the services that are already there. It's also, you know, it's interesting that NGOs have looked at this situation and universities implementing HIV care and have said, we don't have enough human resources to really provide this service. So what they end up doing often is hiring the nurses, three nurses that are providing antenatal care for 100,000 people, and they hire one of them away to provide their little boutique PMTCT services. And, you know, certainly we've been in this situation as well. And, you know, that doesn't make as much sense as training all those three nurses to integrate PMT-CT services into their regular routine care. It actually saves human resources to do it the other way around. Training is consolidated and you get more efficient delivery of services. And just as an illustration of that, looking at this now is that same graph going through 2007 showing all the different interventions. And I just point out that this is the first ANC visit. So coinciding really pretty much, you know, mapping along the syphilis testing, we've seen a real big increase in the last, you know, almost 7 or 8 years, 5 or 6 years, in the number of women accessing antenatal care that's been correlated with this improved quality of services. Of course, that means a lot of women are getting, so 83% there, I can't get my mouse back. Where's my mouse? There it is. So 83% here is 83% of the expected number of pregnant women in any given moment. And about 94% of them are now getting syphilis testing. About 81% of those clinics have intermittent preventive treatment of malaria. About 71% of all women are getting HIV testing, and that's actually gone up in 2008. In a lot of places, almost 90% of women are getting HIV tested. And actually, the other interesting thing is we've seen, this was more steep, but since then a steady and slow increase. So this is still a very challenging one, but in the number of women getting their first antenatal care visit before 24 weeks, which is critical for a lot of interventions, including syphilis testing and treatment, to be most efficacious. So conclusions are similar again to the first presentation, that strengthening the existing public primary care health system is a more effective way to deliver all services, including HIV services. And high-quality, complicated HIV care regimens like antiretroviral treatment can be integrated into small rural health clinics effectively. And the concept of PMTCT must be broadened to focus on the health and well-being of HIV-positive pregnant women as well as their HIV-exposed children. For me, this is a human rights issue that I think has gotten scant attention and that we really need to focus more on. And integrated implementation of multiple programs improves services and helps avoid duplication and wasteful parallel programs and services. Oh, I put my author's disclosure at the end, sorry. A maverick, evidently. I have no conflicts and no financing from outside sources for this. And thanks very much. The Maverick family actually is a bunch of Democrats, and they're quite upset about the appropriation of their name. I'll just add that in. So thanks very much, and we'll open for questions for the entire panel. Appreciate it. Differently in different health centers. There are some health centers that are doing, most health centers are doing a kind of group meeting in the beginning, which includes talking about HIV testing and includes talking about malaria bed nets and some other things as well. So there's sort of a group talk, and then there's sort of another part inside the clinic visit. And the way that this gets implemented is really is a little bit variable across different health centers, but mostly it is opt-out testing. So women are kind of offered the test, and only if they refuse do they not come back. I think the 71%, and as I said, this year it's gotten much closer to the number of the syphilis testing, but some of that actually is due to some stockout problems with tests. Some of that is due to some health system issues as well as to women just refusing the testing. Less and less of it is due to women refusing the testing at this point. So, you want to say something?
Yeah, can people hear me? But there was some, I was in Mozambique about 4 months ago, and a few clinics were actually beginning to try doing syphilis testing and HIV testing together when the syphilis testing was using the rapid test, which is almost identical to the HIV test. And that was, doing that, my guess is that they will probably, the HIV and syphilis testing levels will be about the same. But that probably reflects about 5% of the clinics. So there's still a difference in testing methods in different clinics.
Any other questions back here?
Yes, a question to Steve anyway. Is there a community outreach component in what you're doing? Like, for example, follow-up?
Yeah, we have a model that we use where peer counselors work in the clinics, and they also are linked with community-based NGOs. A lot of times they come from community-based NGOs, and there's also a home-based care program that operates in most of the areas where the Ministry of Health clinics are operated, and they're linked to the Ministry of Health clinics as well. We support those, but they're mostly run by local NGOs, and so those are there is a component that includes.
In your evaluation, do you have any measures? What measures do you have, like coverage, any other measures?
Let me get that.
The measure that I actually didn't talk about much was adherence, and that's a huge issue. And as Wendy was saying, there's a combination of both peer activists and home-based care who are different. The peer activists are working in health facilities and are actually talking to the folks and helping them. Sometimes making home visits. The home-based care folks come from a different angle, but we're trying to move them from palliative care to adherence. At first, our adherence levels were quite high in the decentralization process as a measure, and I can't remember exactly how high they were, but I think they were in the 85 to 90% measured by either self-reported adherence or by drug pickup. As we got to the next level, it was harder to measure those because there were so many units that were doing care. And right now, that's our major effort, is to try to measure adherence because we think that's the biggest concern we have. We actually think that adherence is probably going somewhat down as these large facilities get over their capacity. And we think the adherence is probably better at the smaller units, but we don't have the data to show that.
Other questions for the other?
Yeah, for Rebecca Morgan, I was curious if you could speak to what degree the Mugabe administration influences prevention and treatment in the Zimbabwe.
Just a tiny question.
Wow, that's a great question. Okay. I don't have to think about that. So I actually did this research a little while ago, so I haven't had that much time with it recently. But I actually have had a close friend who's from Zimbabwe, and she's been traveling back and forth and kind of sending out reminders. And it just sounds like it is in such a state of disarray that I can't imagine health messages are really getting out or that funding's really getting in to disseminate any safer sex messages. But hopefully, as more research becomes available, more information can be disseminated, and as that situation settles more and more.
The guys are here.
First question was, how long do they stay?
Right, whether they're tempted or
not. So the external migrants are, in contrary to, you know, Mexican immigrants in this country who may move here and stay, you know, for a long time, the migrants from Tajikistan are usually seasonal migrants or yearly migrants. So they'll go for, you know, one season and they'll come back for the winter holidays or something and spend time with their families at home. And they send, and while there, they send a lot of remittances back to Tajikistan, which is one of actually, you know, it's a lot of Tajik's economy is through international remittances from the migrant workers. They're tested before they head out. And all they have to do is have a slip that's a paper that from the aid center which says that they've been tested negative. I've heard stories of people being able to purchase, you know, these cards if they did in fact test positive in order to work there. And I don't think that they're tested while there at customs or anything. And on their way back, I'm not sure they're tested either. So I hope that answers that first part of your question.
So even if they return and then different things will work and they know they have to go back, let's say, a year later.
Yeah, they would get retested for that. Yeah, I think so. Yeah.
Because I was wondering if that would have been one of the things that might have, that might have been an intervention, that if they were concerned that if they came home and they had to be retested to go back, maybe that fear would prompt them to sort of
And then your second part of your question was?
The second question was about the wives.
Oh, yeah, the wives. So, this expectation that men were expected to have sex away from their wives was something that we interviewed both men and women, and the wives. I didn't present any of the data for the interviews that we did with the wives, but those were conducted as well. And it showed that there was kind of a tacit acceptance of men's behaviors that women knew or suspected that they would happen, that was happening, but they didn't think that there was anything they could do about it. So we are working on peer training modules with the wives too to kind of develop some type of self-efficacy or talking about discussing HIV risk-related behaviors with your husbands and kind of negotiating that, negotiating power within those sexual relationships. That's a different talk.
I guess the issue of
Yeah. So we're studying that group too.
Okay.
Any other last question? I think we're at about time here. Or what? I have like three different times going on up here. Sorry. Does somebody?
I've got 10 minutes.
Oh, okay. Sorry. We have plenty of time for lots more questions. Let's go here and then here.
My question is for Dr. Weicker. I'd be interested in hearing about the training and support.
This is actually Dr. Gloyd, who is presenting for Dr. Piper. It's fine.
Although I like being called Dr. Piper. He's a great guy, much younger than me. That's a great question. And the approach that we use as an NGO, working with the Ministry of Health, is that we minimize formal training and maximize coaching. And the approach is essentially, you know, that yes, we do have occasional two-week training courses, but what we found is the training oftentimes takes people away from their work, particularly because every NGO wants to do a two-week or three-week training course, and it just gets to be crazy, particularly in a place like Mozambique with too few nurses and doctors to be able to carry out the work. So what we try to do is, after the training, do pretty intense supervision, usually weekly supervision and visits, and we call it coaching. Because it's at least our staff don't have a supervisory role. As much as possible, we do it with the local staff, both at a provincial level to districts, and then district level to health facilities. I think the key is to help the logical units of a Ministry of Health improve their own coaching and training and support systems. Because if they make visits on a pretty frequent basis, essentially what they'll be able to do is identify what the bottlenecks are, and there are always bottlenecks in the system. There's stockouts here, there are health workers who are on vacation and aren't replaced, and a lot of times it's just not known very much up the chain of command. So the more that people at districts can actually go to health facilities and understand what's going on, the better. And so what we've tried to do is to model that behavior as much as possible to encourage these, you know, weekly or bi-weekly visits to just check things out. You don't have to have a long visit, but at least to be there. So that's our training and support model. It's increasingly hard to do, as you have, and we'll talk about this this afternoon, migration of people outside of the ministry into NGOs and into other entities. But it does seem to work, and we have seen a remarkable amount of professionalism. You get a small number of stockouts, and you get people knowing what they're supposed to do.
Okay, back here.
My question was actually related to that, in that when you're introducing sort of new programs into, for instance, like an antenatal clinic, do the healthcare workers, do you get a sense that they're perceiving it as more work for me to do, or do you get a sense that perhaps they look at it as more job satisfaction because they can do more?
I think it depends a lot on how it's implemented. And if it's implemented, I think one of the key differences is that if it's seen as implemented by the outside NGO or university sort of imposing this, and if there's some perception of inequity, for example, like some people are getting top-ups and some people aren't, that all causes problems in my experience. When it's best implemented is when it's really seen as coming from the ministry, and when it's seen as being supported by the ministry as well, with the supplies and, you know, the regular, so that I think the staff knows that they're going to have the long-term commitment to this, and it's not something that's just going to come and go with whatever whim of the funder or NGO at the moment. So I think those are key things, and I think when those things are present, and I've seen a situation specifically with the implementation of opt-out testing and counseling, where completely shifted the way that health workers were viewing it and the way that it was getting implemented, simply because the provincial director of health had a meeting with all the MCH nurses and said, look, this is a priority, we're doing this, and everybody needs to do this, and you're going to be evaluated based on how well your health center is doing this. And that, more than anything else, made rates of testing skyrocket. And I think nurses were not, you know, I think nurses did see it. Once it becomes part of the routine provision, and once doctors and nurses, I think clinicians of any kind in Africa, one of their major frustrations is not being able to do what they've been trained to do because they don't have the tools, because they don't have the infrastructure, whatever. And when they're able to do what they were trained to do, and when that's supported by their management structures, I think their job satisfaction, what I've seen, has gone up. Do you want to add anything to that, Steve?
One example of this, which concerned us a lot, was that we wanted to introduce the rapid test for syphilis, and that's a test that can be done either by the prenatal care nurse, or it can be done in the laboratory where the previous test for syphilis, the RPR, was being done. And so we were really concerned about adding more work to already very, very overworked nurses. And so we actually did a study and did the rapid test when it was introduced in the laboratory, and then also they had the nurses do it, and then asked the nurses afterwards what their preference was. And we were very surprised to learn that the nurses almost universally preferred doing the rapid test themselves because it gave them the power and the authority to be able to control their lives, if you will. And to me, that was remarkable, because these are nurses who are paid, you know, $20 to $40 a month. I mean, their salaries are very low. It's lower than it was because of structural adjustment programs and all sorts of other things that have happened over the past couple of decades. And yet, it showed to me, at least, that the real driver of work is professionalism. And if you provide the context and the conditions within which they can be professional, they will, and that they'll do the work remarkably.
Now I will say one last question, I think. Back right here. Yeah.
Thanks. This is for you, Mindy and Tamim. I work in Kenya as well. I guess it could have changed a lot of the name, and it could have been Kenya. But what amazes me is that to make it
easy transition. And yeah. You alluded to the fact that as long as you professionalize, so assist us care workers to professionalize our establishments, then they'll do what they need to do much easier. So you have to think about the infrastructure constraints that we have. How have you overcome those? I mean, most of the time we ask questions like, we're decentralizing, but to what are we decentralizing? It's not just a healthcare issue, it's an infrastructure.
Right.
And in terms of coaching and training, you talk about being able to change perception. Do you have tools? Do you support the Ministry of Health by giving funding for those visits to the district?
Mm-hmm.
Or how do you ensure also that those, you know, the Ministry of Health embraces issues to do with the cost of supervision and integration?
I think the two things are actually intimately related, because the model of giving a two-week training, sending everybody out, and then, you know, maybe coming back in 6 months or a year and seeing how it's going, or even 3 months, is you don't get a lot of information in terms of what the infrastructure needs are. An example, last time I was in Mozambique was in March, and I was in a clinic where the fan had broken, and it made it really unbearable to be in there. And so I think you could have documented this, but I think the duration of visits probably decreased by like 5 or 10 minutes based on the fact that the fan was broken and nobody really wanted to be sitting in there any longer than they had to in this sweltering clinic. And that's a very simple thing to fix. And so doing supervision, and not just ourselves, but doing supervision with the district and provincial health staff of the Ministry of Health is, I think, a key, so that everybody kind of has a good picture of what's needed. And do it, and we do that, you know, at least once, in a lot of cases twice a month, and as much as possible. Usually most of those visits, I would say the vast majority of those visits, are done with either the district health staff or the provincial health staff, and certainly in conjunction with the administrators of the local health unit. So everybody agrees on, okay, so this clinic needs a fan, and little things like that. I mean, a lot of times we're not talking about building a new building, although that too sometimes, but sometimes it's little things that are preventing care from being provided. And if you're not doing that supervision on a regular basis, the coaching that Steve talked about, you're not gonna know that. You're not gonna have any idea. And the other thing I do have to say is, I think a lot of this model is really dependent on relationships. And Healthline, I came to Mozambique in 2004. At that time, Health Alliance International had been working in Mozambique for about 15 years and had been working in these two provinces. And, you know, our model of working is really well recognized from the Ministry of Health. There's a huge amount of trust between the Ministry of Health individuals, even though they might change, and the Health Alliance International individuals, even though we might change. There's just years and years of trust in that relationship that's built, and that they know that we're here to support them, and we know that that's why we're there too. So I think that can't be underestimated. But that's not to say that any other NGO that's only been in a place for a year or two can't do this. It takes time to build those relationships, but you have to start somewhere. And we've started new projects in different places, in Cote d'Ivoire and East Timor and Sudan, and that's a lot. Our model is being implemented the same way there, even though we haven't been there for 20 years. And, you know, that trust, I think, develops very quickly, because it's a way of working that, frankly, a lot of ministries of health haven't really seen before, and so they're very receptive to it. Do you want to add?
Just a couple of additions. I think that was a great summary of the kinds of things that make this possible. But let me say, it's not easy.
Yeah.
By no means is it not easy, and the trust goes both ways. And so I think one of the things that has made it possible over years and years, I mean, it took us 8 years to get syphilis screening going. So you gotta have patience for one. But I think NGOs and donors need to trust the health system. And I think oftentimes we don't. When that health system does have the conditions in which to work, then the people, you know, the people who are the healthcare professionals
become more professional and do their jobs better. Funding for it, I think, to a large extent, has been through our NGO, but what we try to do as much as possible is to provide funding for province-level and district-level managers, and that's been very, very hard to do. We're trying still to do that. We're trying to help donors move basket funding so that you actually have provinces and districts having enough funds for maintenance. It makes no sense for NGOs to fix that fan that Wendy talked about. It makes sense for them to do it themselves. But oftentimes they don't have those funds. So one of the things we do is advocacy to push that funding so that actually districts have their own funding.
Okay. Thanks. I think that's all our time. Some of the presenters might be available here, I'm not sure, for a couple of questions, but we're going to have to get out of the room in the next 5 or 10 minutes. So thanks very much for coming.